dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In that war, one of my close friends and much admired colleagues, a man with an extraordinary background in the service of his country, particularly as an intelligence analyst and practitioner in successive positions in the United States government, is Fred Flights. These days, he is the president and CEO of the Center for Security Policy, but he remains very actively engaged in trying to help the rest of us understand what is happening around the world and its implications for our country and particularly for our security. He is the author of, among other things, Obama Bomb, a very important dissection of the so-called deal with the Iranians on their nuclear weapons program. We're going to talk about Iran in a moment with Fred, but I thought we might start by, first of all, saying, of course, welcome, Fred. Always good to have you back.
Good to be here.
And then secondly, I want to talk with you a little bit about Saudi Arabia. We have a fascinating interview later in the program about what's happening on the ground in Saudi Arabia with Dr. Harold Rode. But I know that an issue has arisen that is roiling U.S.-Saudi relations a bit as a sort of fallout, continuing fallout from the Khashoggi affair. You have weighed in a bit on the importance of the United States maintaining a reliable relationship with Saudi Arabia in terms of supplying it with weaponry. Talk us through what's going on there as you see it, Fred, and the pressure to disrupt U.S.-Saudi relations coming from some quarters of the Congress.
Well, I did an interview for Gillian Turner for Fox News Special Report this week on the controversy over the Trump administration making a huge set of arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Congress wants to block these sales because they object to the war in Yemen, where they think the Saudis are going to use the weapons, and because many members of Congress are still angry over the death of Jamal Khashoggi. And what I'm arguing is that these weapons are not intended to be used in the Yemeni civil war. We're talking to the Saudis about that. But the real aim of this strategy is an effort by the left, and unfortunately a few people on the right, to basically cut off U.S. relations with Saudi Arabia altogether. And, you know, Frank, that would be a disaster. That would be handing the region to Iran. It would force Iran to try to seek weapons from Russia and China. Saudi Arabia's human rights record, as you know, is repugnant in far too many ways. But we live in a dangerous world, and we have to strike deals and work with nations who have values and human rights records that we may find repugnant. And if the standard is we're not going to deal with Saudi Arabia any longer because of its human rights records, well, let's just shut down all trade with China, because China is running internment camps for the Uyghur Muslims. They're persecuting Christians. They're persecuting the people of Tibet. We have to find a standard that allows us to promote our national security interests and encourage states to promote good human rights records. But the less effort to shut down U.S. relations with Saudi Arabia, it would be a disaster. Unfortunately, Senate leaders and the president are just not standing for that.
Yeah, I could actually make an argument for disengaging quite fully with the Chinese, Fred. But on the Saudi story, let me just say, the beneficiaries of such a cutoff would not just be the Iranians, which would be bad enough. It would be the Qataris. It would be the Muslim Brotherhood, which they so aggressively support, as does another of the possible beneficiaries, Turkey, with whom we are currently seeing increasing evidence of something we've written about here at the Center for Security Policy in the past, that it is an ally no more. This would be really the height of folly, it seems to me, to be playing into the hands of such unsavory sorts in the interest of sort of salving some sort of wound over the Khashoggi affair. Fred, let me turn to Iran a little bit more. You have been talking now for some time about the charge that President Trump is being drawn into a war he doesn't want with Iran because John Bolton is sending weapons and carriers and crews into the region. And yet, you've pointed out, I think quite properly, what President Trump is doing with John Bolton's help, obviously, is defensive in character. Talk about where you see things standing at the moment in that regard.
There's been so much fake news on this, Frank. Let's be clear. This was a president who was elected to get the United States out of wars, to stop wars, not to start new ones. And he does not want to get into a war with Iran. He said that repeatedly. Now, I've known John Bolton for over 20 years, maybe almost 30 years. I've lost track. And he's very clear that foreign policy decisions are made by the president. He often says, look, we work for the guy who won the election. He sets the policy. Mr. Bolton has always been extremely clear about that. And he gives his frank advice to the president, but he's not doing things that the president doesn't want him to do. He's clearing what he does very carefully with the president. What we did in the Persian Gulf region was to send additional military forces because of intelligence that the Iranians were planning to engage in violent acts, including stepped up terrorism and attacks against U.S. military bases because they're angry that we withdrew from the Iran deal. And that's led the left to make arguments that the president is responsible for Iran engaging in violence for backing out of the Iran deal. I'm sorry. We don't stay in an agreement because the other party threatens to attack us if we withdraw. That's called blackmail. That's a reason not to be in this agreement, aside from all the other reasons you and I have discussed over the years.
Yeah. Fred, the U.S. government seems to have now formally recognized that the Iranians are violating this agreement through the work they're doing with advanced centrifuges. This is hardly a surprise. I think you and your writings and public appearances on Fox and elsewhere have long been warning that we don't know the full extent of what the Iranians are doing, particularly in these underground facilities that are off limits to so-called inspections. Talk us through what the latest reading by the government is with respect to this fiction, shall we say, that the Iranians are actually somehow being constrained by this agreement, even after we've pulled out of it.
Well, the U.S. ambassador to the IAEA, Jackie Sanders, recently said that Iran is producing excess enriched uranium and is operating advanced centrifuges in violation of the agreement. Those things are true, but frankly, the violations of Iran of this agreement are far more obvious and have happened since the very beginning, and they include not allowing the IAEA to inspect military facilities. But the U.S. has finally made a very firm charge that is impossible for Iran to disprove, that it is cheating. I frankly think that these claims that it's cheating are basically a pittance compared to the other huge examples of cheating, but it's a start. And I'd like to see how the other parties to the agreement are going to respond to this.
Fred Flights, it's always good to talk with you about these things, and I appreciate so much you're taking the time to do it. Thanks for the work you're doing these days leading our Center for Security Policy. Come back to us next week. Next up, we will speak with Kevin Freeman, our duty expert on economic warfare, what the Chinese are up to in that regard, and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back for our weekly visit with Kevin Freeman. He is our duty expert at Secure Freedom Radio for matters involving economic warfare, the subject of his terrific program at Blaze TV, Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. It's also the subject of his two very important books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan. And Kevin is, of course, a senior fellow with the Center for Security Policy, a member of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, who contributed to an important program in Dallas, Texas, where he lives. And it's always a delight to catch up with him on the air and otherwise. Kevin, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be here.
Well, I'm bemused, I guess is the only way to describe it, by the fact that Joe Biden, the Democratic presidential frontrunner, has gone from being actually rather contemptuously dismissive of the idea that there's any threat posed to us by communist China to now being evidently of the view that they actually do present a real threat to us in some areas, though he blames it on Donald Trump somehow. What do you make of this latest contortion by Joe Biden, Kevin, and where does the truth lie with respect to whether there's a threat or not from China?
Well, I'm just assuming that Joe Biden didn't get the memo that it's okay to acknowledge China as a threat, because the Democratic Party, and particularly under the Clintons, had dismissed that threat for so long. They were complicit in working with communist China, helping them get most favored nation status. So I just assume he hadn't gotten the memo. He finally must have gotten the memo and realized that most of Silicon Valley understands that China has, you know, at least the parts of Silicon Valley not owned by China, understands that China steals our technology. It is just obvious. When President Trump first came into office, there was an opposition to the idea that China was a bad actor, and I think that's kind of gone away now. People realize they have hacked everything. They've stolen intellectual property. They're abusing their people. They're human rights violators. You go down the list, and Biden was ignoring them, and I think he was ignoring them because of family financial connections, like Peter Schweitzer pointed out in his book.
Like $1.5 billion worth of financial connections. This is not trivial.
It's unreal that, you know, and this is in secret empires. It's unreal that the Chinese allowed the vice president to come in with his son on Air Force Two. And, you know, Biden comes back soft on China, and Hunter Biden comes back with $1.5 billion contract.
Which, it's safe to say, Kevin Freeman, and you're an expert in these things as a certified financial analyst, that Hunter Biden would not have gotten that kind of money from the Chinese communists were there not this Guangxi, as they call it, these connections and the possibility that they would pay dividends for them in American policy, right?
Well, what I can say, I can't say we're certain, but what I can say is I know a lot of people who've flown to China with tremendous credentials, business ideas, opportunities, everything else, that did not get lucrative contracts like that. This is not in his field. Now, he may be some savant that has some expertise that I don't know.
Well, the Ukrainians thought so, too, at some point, but there's reason to believe that may have been for the same ulterior reason of trying to influence his father. Well, I take the point. We don't know for sure, but it quacks like a duck for sure, as far as I'm concerned. Hey, Kevin, let me ask you further on this point about China and the threat that it represents. You and some of our other colleagues, Kyle Bass and Roger Robinson, Steve Bannon, have in programs that we've done with the Committee on the Present Danger China made the point that we've been underwriting what the Chinese communists are doing in so many areas, including some that are direct and material threats to us. Make no mistake about it, whether Joe Biden acknowledges it or not, they are. These involve things like surveillance technology, building fortified islands in the South China Sea, building aircraft carriers and the like, which Roger Robinson makes a pretty compelling case as being subsidized, if not out and out underwritten, by American investors. This brings me to a very important initiative that you've promoted over the years, the National Security Investment Consultants Institute. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about what you've been doing in that institute and how it might tie in very importantly to an initiative that Ellen Lord, the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition, has recently unveiled, aimed at trying to, well, recruit, I guess it's the right verb for it, recruit patriot investors, people who will help our country with their investments. Walk through that with us, if you would.
Sure. Well, the general notion is that when you make an investment, you want a return on your money, you want a return of your money, but you also want to do some social good with it. And there's an entire field of investing called socially responsible investing. where people say, hey, I would love to develop a new energy source so that we don't have to burn fossil fuels, or I would love to do something that would provide to alleviate poverty in other countries or whatever. People like the idea of doing good with their money as well as getting a good return. Now, China has manipulated our markets in such a way that they've actually accumulated American capital for their purposes. And I think Americans, when they're woke to this fact that they are funding things that might be human rights violations, I mean, just imagine if you went back a certain number of years and you said, well, Americans, you're investing in these countries that are enslaving people and selling them around the world, and you're actually facilitating and profiting from that, people would be abhorred by it. They'd say, that's terrible. We cannot do that. Well, in essence, there are Americans invested in Chinese companies that may be spying on the people in China, that may be violating human rights, that may be involved in this transplantation business where people literally, they're taking organs out of political prisoners and selling them.
Harvesting, I think, is the term for it.
Oh, it's terrible. Or they're building aircraft carriers with which they're going to extend power and build the Chinese century that they're planning on and displace the United States. You know, people's money is being actually used to destroy the America that we love. And so we think that there should be patriotic investors that should be informed, and they should be investing in things that not only we're not all citizens of the world. I believe that America is exceptional. I believe that America has a great leadership role in the world. We're not perfect. We've made mistakes, but it's better than the alternatives. And I think we need to support the United States of America and defend us. And so I think investors, as I've been in the investment field my entire career, I work with great investors like John Templeton, who was managed billions of dollars. We ought to mobilize Americans to where they're investing, getting good returns, but not transferring our technology overseas, not doing human rights violations. So we've created this idea of patriotic investors. At the same time, there's an initiative in the Pentagon under Ellen Lord where the goal is to identify investors who will invest in technologies that will benefit American national security and help us, you know, like we were patriotic and had the space program, and we got a lot of positive investment returns out of that. We ought to be finding ways that work to cooperate with the Pentagon so we're not looking for Chinese money, which comes in and buys up the technology and then makes it available to China. It's a new way of thinking, but it is a very logical way of thinking. It's something I think investors want, and it's something obviously the Pentagon wants.
Well, it's obvious that if they're not channeling you, they're thinking along similar lines, and I commend Undersecretary Lord for doing so. And it seems, Kevin Freeman, that the work that you've been about in training investment advisors to help investors make those patriotic decisions and more to the point, avoiding the kinds of investments that are really harmful to our country. And by the way, as you know, Kevin, one of the things that is a particular concern to many of us is that it's becoming harder and harder for investors to really understand who they're investing in when they go into, for example, the MSCI index and developing markets. Lo and behold, increasingly there are Chinese companies in that portfolio, and many of them, it seems, are really problematic. But there's no disclosure of the material risk associated with doing business with these companies, because they're not obliged to do the same thing as our American companies when it comes to risk, or for that matter, transparency and accountability more generally. Explain how that is, Kevin, if you would. Well, how is it that the Chinese can be in our markets without that kind of, well, comparable degree of transparency and risk accountability and the like to their American counterparts?
Well, there's several ways. There are Chinese companies listed on the New York Stock Exchange and listed in the NASDAQ and available in the over-the-counter markets. They don't conform to the same accounting standards that American companies do. And even if they did, they would be reported information that you wouldn't actually be able to dig down into unless you flew to Beijing and looked at these. I worked for John Templeton, and we used to look at international companies, and they have, each nation has its own accounting standards, and the requirement is you meet the accounting standards of your nation. Well, if the government is complicit, or the government is the owner of the, you know, these are state-owned assets, it's almost impossible to really dig into it. So it's caveat emptor. It's let the buyer beware. But it gets even worse when you talk about index investing, because the index logically looks over and says the Chinese economy is substantial. We ought to have a certain amount of investment in China, and the MSCI has recently doubled their weighting for China. You don't know. You're just buying an index of international stocks. You have no idea what's in there. And the companies that they may be, you may have no idea what the underlying company actually does, but it's of a certain market cap. And so it doesn't matter if they produce bicycles or B-2 bombers or, you know, not B-2, but bombers or whatever. You have no idea what they just happen to hit a certain market cap, meaning that means how much the company is listed for being worth. And if you say, well, it's a $5 billion company, well, our cutoff is $2 billion. Of course it gets included in the index.
Kevin, we have to leave it at that for the moment. We appreciate so much your visits with us each week. We'll look forward to talking with you next. Up next is Diana West, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined, as we have the privilege of being from time to time, by a good friend, a longtime colleague, and much admired expert on matters involving particularly the Middle East, most especially Iran and Turkey, two of its most problematic players at the moment. He is Dr. Harold Rode. He served for many years as a senior official in the U.S. Defense Department, the Turkish desk officer for a time, also in the storied ranks of Andy Marshall's net assessment team. He is the author, among other things, of Modern Islamic Warfare, An Ancient Doctrine Marches On. He is also a distinguished senior fellow at the Gatestone Institute, and as I say, always a welcome guest here. Harold, good to have you back. Thank you for joining us.
Nice to be back, Frank. Always nice to hear your voice.
Thank you. So, Harold, you have called to my attention something that seems to have been largely overlooked by most of us, including, I have to say, myself to some extent, and that is that there is a war going on at the moment in the Red Sea, critical waterway, particularly for American battle groups that transit the Suez Canal to get to the Middle East from the Atlantic without having to go around the Horn of Africa. Tell us a bit about what's going on there and who seems to be the prime mover behind it, and what are the prospects for it coming out in a way that would be very disadvantageous to us, among others.
Well, it boils down to a holy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Iran is Shiite, Saudi Arabia is Sunni. The rulers of Saudi Arabia are Sunni. Iran is supplying the Houthis. These are the people in Yemen, which is taking, or the Houthis are taking over territory in southern Saudi Arabia on the border of the Houthi land, and they're taking it, and they're staying there.
Let me just make sure I understand this. You're talking not about Yemen, which is across that border, of course, but some of the desert area that's actually on the Saudi side of the border as well?
That's right. And that area isn't desert. That area has cities, and they are largely Shiite. And even though the Saudi government is Wahhabi, which is extreme, extreme fundamentalist Islam, Sunni Islam, and they hate the Shiites, there are Shiites in the south, and there are Shiites where the oil is, in fact, it's overwhelmingly Shiite, where the Saudis have oil. Now, what is happening here is that the Houthis have moved into southern Saudi Arabia, and they're staying. They are destroying air bases, which the Saudis use to protect the area. The Saudi soldiers are really, they don't know what to do, or they're doing nothing. And then to make matters worse, along the southern eastern side of the Red Sea, there's a province called Jizan, and that province is also filled with Shiites, and the Houthis are moving in there, all totally Iranian-backed, Iranian supply. Now, why that is important is that it's up the coast, along the coast, that you have Mecca and Medina, which are the central sites, the most important cities in Islam. So this is part of the Iran versus Saudi Arabia war for control of Islam. So you've got that there. In the Gulf, where the Persian Gulf, where the oil is, all that area in Saudi Arabia, where the largest fields are, is the population there is Shiite. And remember now that the government of Saudi Arabia hates the Shiites. Now, Iran wants to dismember Saudi Arabia. And again, so that is what's behind this. In other words, taking over the holy cities of Islam and dismembering Saudi Arabia. Now, it sounds like, oh, my God, Iran is in really, you know, strong, in great shape. At the same time, it's disintegrating internally. You are having in the Iranian leadership overt public criticisms of, for example, the leader, who's Khamenei. He's called the supreme leader. The equivalent title is the Führer, like the Germans called Hitler. And he is criticizing the Iranian president for corruption, among other things. And the most important military leader in Iran is a guy named Qasem Soleimani, who is a totally self-made man, poor as could be, who has risen among the ranks, and he runs what is called the Quds Force. Now you have he and the brother of the Iranian president, Rouhani. There is public criticism of their wives, that is of Rouhani and Qasem Soleimani, for corruption. And this is people eating each other alive. And this shows weakness to the Iranian people, and it, among other things, gives them incentives to continue to want to fight the regime and to stand up. And now more than ever, it is important that the United States support them. How do you support them? The idea of slowly but surely continuing and upping the sanctions, which is what the United States is doing. And hopefully we can have a regime change there with a sane government, sane is defined as doesn't want to make problems for the rest of the world, that the Iranian people can do it themselves. But our job here in the United States, our government, which we're doing very nicely, is to squeeze and squeeze and squeeze the Iranian regime. And we're seeing at that point also, we're seeing the desired effect because they're all fighting each other. And that will give the internal people strength. They also, the people need to know that America, the strongest power on the face of the earth, is with them. And our president is doing a great job at trying to support them.
So, Harold Rode, the bottom line on this, as I understand it, then, is the Iranians are on the march and putting tremendous pressure, it sounds like, on the Saudi regime. They're facing their own internal difficulties. And your sort of recommendation to President Trump is to try to help relieve the pressure on the Saudis by intensifying further with, obviously, at the forefront, the Iranian people themselves, the pressure on the Iranian regime at home. So when the president says, as he did the other day, that he's more than happy to make a deal with the Iranian regime on this so-called, well, follow-on to a new agreement to replace the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Obama-era deal with Iran on its nuclear program, which it appears now the U.S. government is saying the Iranians are violating in their own right. We've withdrawn from it, of course, but they are now violating it as well. Does that send the wrong message to the people of Iran? that instead of standing with them, instead of encouraging them to dispose of this nightmare for them and for us, the Ayatollah's regime in Tehran, he's actually prepared to do business with them, even if it's on a better basis, hopefully, than did Obama.
On the surface, I agree. What do I mean on the surface? In the Middle East, you only negotiate after you win. If you try to negotiate before you win, you are indicating that you don't have the will or the ability to do what it's necessary to defeat your enemy. The Middle Easterners see that as weakness, and it gives them incentive to fight against you. But at the same time, the Iranian people is seeing that we are constantly squeezing more and more. As you just said, Frank, we just said that they were violating the terms of that horrible agreement. And so at best, I would say it confuses them. But the goal, I said, overall, is we are going in the right direction by squeezing more and more. Something's going to give here. I don't know what. I don't know how. You can't predict when.
But it is striking, Harold, that we're hearing so little about the Houthis being inside of Saudi territory. We hear about drone strikes. We hear about you know, what they're doing in Yemen, of course. But the fact that they're physically present in occupying Saudi territory, and perhaps with the help of Shia in other parts of the kingdom, in a position to, fracture the place. It seems to be a story that one would think would get some attention. How could that be that it's not?
Well, there are YouTube videos on this. You can see them. You can see the Houthi troops overlooking Najran, this big city in the south, where they lob missiles into. About a year ago, just as another thing, the Houthis sent missiles into Abu Dhabi, which is on the Persian Gulf, and everybody denied it. Well, the Houthis have now released the details, not the details, the actual videos of hitting the airport. And if anybody who's been in the airport in Abu Dhabi will tell you that they recognize things that are in these videos. So it's there if we want to know about it. But again, our media doesn't seem to want to know about it. Just to give you another example, there was a very large, when President Trump was just in the UK, there was a very large rally in his favor, very large. And you can see this on the internet as well, the videos of the rally. But was that covered? No, only the small protest rallies, they were all covered. So, unfortunately, our media is not reporting news by and large. What it's reporting, it's a political hack organization.
Well, the question is our government paying attention to some of these developments? I'm sorry that you're not part of it any longer, Harold Rode, as your expertise is tremendously needed there. But I'm trusting that through outlets like ours and the Gatestone Institute and your ongoing relationships with those in government, that you are continuing to let them know. We have to leave it at that, my friend. I'm so appreciative of your time as well as your continuing public service. Harold, come back to us again soon.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's time for our weekly visit with Diana West, the author most recently of The Red Thread, a search for the ideological drivers behind the anti-Trump conspiracy. She's also the author of American Betrayal, and before that, The Death of the Grown-Up. She frequently contributes to the public policy debate through vehicles like The Daily Caller and, of course, her own tremendously useful website, dianawest.net. But not least, through our conversations with her each week, we're always delighted to have her. Diana, welcome back.
Oh, thank you. Wonderful to be back.
You have been, of course, continuing your analysis and commentary about what you describe in The Red Thread, which is the motivations and the real driving forces behind this anti-Trump conspiracy. Of course, a critical moment in it was the revelation that the DNC, the Democratic National Committee's servers, had spewed forth some very sensitive emails that embarrassed the Clinton team, then candidate Clinton's campaign, which in short order turned into allegations that the Russians had hacked the DNC computers and made this information available through WikiLeaks. You don't think that's so, I gather, and I'd like you to talk us through that a little bit, because it's now a subject of continuing focus, of course, on Capitol Hill with the Democratic investigation into these matters, such as it is, and the investigation now underway in the Department of Justice under Attorney General Barr and U.S. Attorney John Durham. Talk us through that.
Yes, well, this is a very important moment that has been essentially paved over with macadam and tar and pitch that and locked up, because this is, for me, where the entire Trump-Russia collusion hoax starts, even more, in some ways, even more so than the notorious Steele dossier, which was starting to come together at this same point in midsummer 2016. What we had happen was, yes, this revelation from the DNC of emails that were actually not so embarrassing to Hillary Clinton per se, but actually just mainly to the DNC itself, which was revealed in these emails to have been essentially favoring Hillary Clinton, rigging the primary process, if you will, against her main rival, Bernie Sanders. This was the crux of that first email reveal that WikiLeaks dropped during the week of the Democratic National Convention. So it was almost, the Hillary emails are almost separate, or they are separate from that, from her server. This is something else again. And what we see is the Clinton campaign manager, this was Robbie Mook, on first being questioned about the embarrassment of seeing the DNC essentially pulling strings for his candidate, coming to her moment of glory at the convention by people such as Jake Tapper. I mean, there were people upset about this. You see Mook, the first person that I can tell, sort of parrying the whole thing or using jujitsu to turn the whole thing into a discussion of, oh, but the Russians did it. We have reason to believe that the Democratic National Committee was attacked by Russia. And this is sort of where you see the whole narrative take place in a very strong way. The way had been paved by revelations the previous month that, yes, Russia had hacked the DNC. We started getting this sort of information warfare preparation preceding this big reveal. So this is a place where we need evidence, and we have none, at least from the FBI, which did not investigate the server, from Special Counsel Mueller's investigation, who says in his report that they did not investigate themselves. And we have essentially a narrative being muscled over by the DNC, relying on its own contractor, a company called CrowdStrike, which was co-founded by a Mueller protege and, what do you know, a Soviet immigrant. This is CrowdStrike. They said Russia hacked the DNC, and we have no further official evidence. What we do have on the other side of this is evidence amassed by a bunch of intelligence professionals led by former NSA tech director William Binney, who compiled a forensic dossier that suggests that, shouldn't use the word dossier, but a file, let's say, of evidence that strongly suggests that this was not a foreign hack or an outside hack, but rather computer information, emails that were downloaded from within and probably moved to a memory stick or a CD-ROM and actually physically carried to WikiLeaks, which completely overturns the whole narrative, which Mueller has nailed down with indictments of Russian military officers over in Russia for this alleged crime. And what we're seeing is sort of the waters closing over this as something that will not be further investigated, because it's the baseline of the agenda against President Trump, essentially delegitimizing his election by implying, suggesting in this way, falsely attempting to prove that he is somehow in there.
Yeah. You know, one of the other pieces of this, Dinah, that you describe in your book, The Red Thread, and that I think is so material here, is that John Brennan, who it's pretty clear was at the very center of this whole anti-Trump conspiracy, and we've certainly seen him continuing to play a role prominently as a CNN paid on-air talent. But he got the myth sort of manufactured and then widely disseminated that the intelligence community had examined this Russian role in the servers and had unanimously come to the conclusion that there was indeed a Russian hack, and the Russians were behind this leak to WikiLeaks, and the Russian conspiracy then was on in full cry, as they say. The trouble is that that wasn't true, that John Brennan had hand-selected a couple of people in various intelligence agencies, not all of them by any means, and got them to sort of endorse this narrative. But it was a complete fabrication that John Brennan, you know, had the entire United States intelligence community behind him on this, just as it seems as though the story itself, the underlying proposition, was manufactured, at least was not supported by a rigorous and firsthand investigation of the facts, the forensics of the server by the FBI. So it's a scandal on top of a scandal, isn't it?
Well, it really is. And one point that William Binney makes, based on these years of service in the NSA, indeed, he developed these metadata collection programs that are still being used against us at this point and became a CIA whistleblower at a certain, or NSA whistleblower at a certain point. One thing he said, I recently interviewed him, and he said that had the Russians done this, the NSA would have the essentially, in layman's terms, the paths by which these documents were extracted from the DNC servers. They would be able to follow this information. They would have it absolutely tied up to a complete case. And we have not had that information put forward to us. We have not had that claim made to us, certainly not shown to us. So the whole thing is very deceptive. It is a deception on the American people, perpetrated by the likes of John Brennan and many others from the intelligence community who, as you allude to, are now actually pundits. I mean, this is one of the real mind games that we're being plagued with in terms of these intelligence mouthpieces that have moved into the media. Lee Smith wrote a great piece about this recently at Tablet, listing a bunch of these former intelligence people who are now disseminating directly as pundits or journalists. And so this is part of this fake, this head fake that we are being victimized by. But again, think how important it is to the entire conspiracy against President Trump. It's not, in other words, you can bite away at the pieces of it, but if you leave that elemental notion that yes, the Russians attacked the DNC on behalf of Donald Trump's presidential aspirations, if you leave that in place and do not seek the evidence one way or the other, let's be fair, but if you leave that as a given, you are leaving the notion that he is not legitimate on the table. And it doesn't matter if you're Attorney General Barr or former Defense Secretary Gates, if you're saying the same thing, that the Russians interfered with the 2016 election, meaning that they attacked the Hillary camp, you are pushing this same deception on the American people and against President Trump.
Dinah West, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but I know this is not the end of this conversation. We'll be back to you more with updates on this, I know. Dinah West, thank you so much for joining us today. Come back to us again next week. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.